Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight it's my pleasure to welcome Jeff Rosley. He's an author of 9 books and over 50 published articles, as well as numerous photos in academic and mainstream periodicals, including Newsweek, Chicago Magazine, ABA Journal, Family Law Review, Pacific Magazine, Indies Child, the Journal of Communal Societies, The Chrysalis Reader, Faith and Fitness Magazine, Friends Journal, and Real Life Travel Adventures International Magazine. He's been a featured guest on over 70 radio programs. Jeff practiced law for 30 years in Indianapolis, Indiana, and was admitted to the U.S. Supreme Court Bar. He's a graduate of the University of Chicago and a letter winner in swimming and football, the Indiana University School of Law, the Christian Theological Seminary, where he was valedictorian and faculty award scholar. Rosley is currently partner with his wife, Alicia, in Midsummer Books, president of the Bassa Village Foundation, USA liaison for the Nepal-based Himalayan Expedition Company, Adventure Geo Treks Limited, and teaches a class on philosophy of philanthropy for Butler University Honors Program. He serves as an officer or director of 6 nonprofit corporations, and so I'd like to welcome Jeff. Jeff, once again, how are you tonight?
Oh, well, thank you, David. I'm feeling very well, although the heat index was up to 100 here in Indianapolis today. So, but good to be with you.
Well, I can relate to the heat. It's been pretty hot in Syracuse, too. Well, it's great to have you with us. Did I pronounce your last name correctly? I'm sorry I didn't ask before the show began.
It's all right. You pronounce it the way it should be, but my family pronounces it Raisley with a long A.
Oh, do they really? Well, at any rate, Raisley or Rosley, Jeff's website is www.jeffreyrosley.com, and Jeffrey is spelled J-E-F-F-R-E-Y. Rosley is R-A-S-L-E-Y, so it's jeffreyrosley.com. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about your background as a writer and how you ever began that journey into that part of your life.
Well, I've been around writers all my life. My mom was a journalist and the city editor of our local paper in the town where I grew up, Goshen, Indiana. I married a writer. My wife, Alicia, had her first novel published when she was about 21 years old, and is even a more prolific writer than me, and she's an English professor, so I've been surrounded with it and have loved reading since I was a little kid. You know, I loved playing sports and I loved reading about sports and history, and so you know, that I've just been around the written word my whole life.
Well, let's talk about a couple of your books. As I mentioned, I'd like to talk about your latest one, Hero's Journey. Would you tell us a little bit about what that's about?
Yeah. The broad theme that it's about is what is a real hero, especially in these days and times when that term is going through a real transformation. Because classically, you know, a hero was a conqueror, a champion, but now you're just as likely to hear the term used, at least by the news media, referring to a victim as likely as you are to a rescuer. So, for example, you know, journalists refer to the victims of 9/11 as heroes. And so I thought that's really kind of an interesting cultural transformation, and what does that say about the modern world? And I wanted to trace that back through ancient times up through how the understanding of hero has changed. And I came to a conclusion that best definition of hero is not just a champion, and it's not just a victim, but it's a combination of both. There's a wonderful writer called Joseph Campbell, who's probably America's greatest mythologist in terms of studying ancient myths and stories. And he came up with what he called the hero's journey. And a hero's journey, in order to become a true hero, you had to start out as a champion, but then you had to fail, and what he called fall into the abyss, and where you your life as this, you know, this great champion ended, and you had to struggle and find a way to come out of that abyss. And what you came out of, or what you came out as, was more of a teacher, a mentor, a wise man, a sage. And so that's the hero's journey. And so to qualify as a true hero, you have to be more than just a champion. You have to have not just won, you have to have lost, and you have to have even lost your identity as a champion, and then regained it and come back to your community to offer wisdom to the community. And so that's what sort of the overall theme of the book is about, and it examined the lives of ancient and modern champions, you know, from Moses to Michael Jordan. But it features someone who is a hero of mine as a child, and his name is John Ritter, and he was the greatest athlete from my hometown. And he was a guy who wasn't just a great athlete, he was a brilliant student, he was just an outstanding person in every way. In fact, we used to marvel at how he just seemed to be perfect. You know, he was the sort of kid that the parents would say, you know, why can't you be more like John Ritter? Because he was just good at everything. He was the best at everything. And he went on to become a star basketball player at Indiana University, was on controversial coach Bob Knight's first Final Four team, was the captain of that team. And everybody expected him to become a star in the NBA, but for various reasons he didn't. But he coached for a while, and then he was an executive at Indiana's biggest corporation, Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company. And after some years, he disappeared. And I eventually heard that he had become a homeless drunk and cab driver. And so that really intrigued me, and I tracked him down, and what I discovered is his life had followed that pattern of the hero's journey. So to explain the hero's journey in very concrete detail of one example, the book includes a biography of him. It describes what he's gone through and how he's come out of the abyss and is once again living a good and decent life. But he's certainly not the conquering hero that we thought of him when he was a great athlete, setting all sorts of scoring records in our little hometown.
What happened to him after his descent into homelessness and problems with alcohol?
So you want me to give the book away, huh?
No, I don't want you to do that.
Spoiler alert.
That's curiosity, but no. Just share whatever you're comfortable with. I just was curious as to what his journey was, and I trust that part of what leads somebody to that point where they become sages and have gained wisdom is that they've gone through a transformation.
Exactly. And what happened with John is that he really he cracked under the pressure of having to be perfect and went from one extreme to another. And so he needed time in the wilderness. And so he became a homeless cab driver for a period of years. And once he even saw an old classmate of his, who is a mutual friend of mine, who related this story to me, my friend saw him scalping tickets outside of a rock concert, and he rolled his window down and yelled at him, "Hey, John, how are you?" And John looked at him and said, "I'm not that John Ritter anymore," and turned his back and walked away. And that is, I mean, it's just this classic perfect example of Joseph Campbell was describing of how to become a true hero, the champion has to fall into the abyss, obliterate his former identity as, you know, the champion, as the perfect guy, as the winner, and then come out of it. But you have to spend that time in the wilderness. You know, Jesus, 40 days in the desert. I mean, Muhammad on the mountain. There's all, you know, all sorts of stories in legends and myths and classical literature about how great people, to become truly great, you know, beyond just being a winner, have to spend that time in the wilderness. And that's what John did.
Well, that makes perfect sense to me. And one of the questions you provided for me before the show was, what's the difference between hero and celebrity? And what I was hearing in the beginning was that John Ritter really was more of a celebrity. And it was after his experience, his further experiences in life, that he transformed into becoming a hero. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, these, you know, the entertainers, movie stars, great sports athletes, you know, the Olympians that were able to watch on TV this week with the Olympics going on. I mean, these are great people in the sense of their accomplishment, but in terms of being a great person deeply spiritually who can mentor younger people, who can offer wisdom, you know, that doesn't come from being able to dunk a basketball or throw a touchdown pass or win a political election. You know, that kind of deep wisdom that can be offered that comes from going through those stages of not only seeing and experiencing the heights, but also the depths of humanity and human suffering.
Well, without that, I don't think that anybody really comes to a place of balance within their lives. And wouldn't you agree that we need to take a look at the dark sides of ourselves, which if we're living on a pedestal trying to project this image of being perfect, we oftentimes don't see that aspect of ourselves. And until we can come to terms with all that we are as imperfect human beings, we are actually denying part of our humanity.
Definitely. I mean, there's a part in the book, Hero's Journey, about how depression can be a valuable experience. I mean, it's not something I would encourage anybody to go out and try to be depressed. That'll make you wise. Well, I'm not saying that, but what I am saying is that periods of time where you become very introspective and where you cut yourself off from the busyness of life, those periods, even though they may be painful, can be wonderful in terms of the ultimate growth of the person. And so that's, you know, again, that's what that time in the wilderness, that time in the desert can offer. Now, of course, it also can lead you to suicide or, just being depressed the rest of your life. So they're out of that suffering, you know, there has to come also a sense of greater strength. The three classical virtues of a hero are courage, compassion, and wisdom. And so the young hero typically has courage. And that's what we see. And I mean, my God, the courage to, in front of thousands of people, to be able to perform the way celebrities do, actors, entertainers, athletes, politicians, you know, those folks obviously have a lot of courage, but do they have compassion? Do they have wisdom? You know, how do you gain those more mature virtues?
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you do attain those more mature virtues.
Well, it doesn't come easily, and I would say actually not many people do attain those. I think we probably all know lots of, very good and decent folks, but how many people are there in this world who really exemplify all of those virtues of courage, compassion, and wisdom? When someone is recognized for having those virtues and living that sort of life, and offering compassion and wisdom in a courageous way, you know, that's a prophet. I mean, that's a leader. That's somebody who is truly a great personality. And that doesn't just mean they have charisma, because, you know, snake oil salesman might have charisma.
Right.
But someone who is recognized as having that depth that, you know, we want to be around that. We want to, you know, kind of feel that vibe and gain that wisdom and feel that compassion. You know, those are really unique individuals. There aren't very many of them.
Well, I think the only way that you can begin to develop compassion is when you have gone through the dark night of the soul and have experienced pain and the ability to empathize with others as opposed to just sympathizing with them through similar life experiences.
Yeah, one of the personalities that is described in the book as someone who is a celebrity, very popular, but is not a hero because he has not had the hero gone through the hero's journey is Donald Trump. And sorry if you didn't want politics to be brought into this, but you know this
okay.
this is a person who does not seem to have compassion. You know, he makes fun of people instead of feeling with them, and does not seem to have wisdom. You know, he offers platitudes and gestures and antagonism as opposed to deeply thought out answers. He does have courage. There's no doubt about that. And he describes himself as a winner who never backs down. But he's more like a king than a hero. You know, he rules over the Trump empire, but he has not lived a heroic life, and he has not made the hero's journey. And it's really obvious when you see the way he behaves that he lacks those two essential virtues of compassion and wisdom.
Well, I have no problem with you bringing him up as an example. I think that you make a really good case for somebody that is not leading the life of a hero, and we do need to have examples of that too. So thank you for mentioning him.
Well, I use that very same example in the book, and I was writing it during the primary season. So it was completed before he actually won the nomination as the Republican candidate. But I find his personality really interesting because a friend who's a psychology professor remarked to me a while ago that he used to have trouble explaining the narcissistic personality to his class. He said now all he has to do is show a YouTube of Donald Trump.
Oh, well, there you go. Now, does your book include life journeys of other heroes besides John Ritter?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
It doesn't go into the detail of anybody else, but it mentions many, biblical heroes, historical heroes, legendary heroes. You know, mentions Arthur, Lancelot, Abraham Lincoln, and as well as a bunch of sports heroes. So I try to trace the historical development of the term by using examples because, you know, it's kind of boring to just sort of explain something like this in very academic terms. It's, I think, a lot more fun and interesting to use illustrations. So the book is full of those.
I agree. What's the most important message you hope people will take away from the book?
Well, from the perspective of those of us who are not heroes, I think the message I want us regular folks is to have some compassion for those people who are on the hero's journey. We're so quick to see people who are in the public eye as having feet of clay. You know, we leap on the errors that people make. And, the greatest people in the world make mistakes. I know that the Christian mythology of Jesus is he was perfect. But if you read the Gospels, he wasn't. I mean, he insulted.
Right.
you know, he insulted people who were hosting him in his in their own homes. He obviously wasn't a great trial lawyer for himself, since he lost the case. But you know, but his personality was so deep and so compassionate and so wise. He had this incredible effect on people, and yet they crucified him. And we do that, you know, not in a literal sense, but in a metaphorical sense, with great people, with people in the public eye routinely. You know, you're a politician, and maybe you're doing a really great job as a statesman, but you know, you have an affair, something like that, in your private life, and oh my God, you've gone from being the savior to the goat, just like that, because you did this thing that was wrong. And so that's one of the points I make is, you know, for somebody who is in the public eye, let's be as compassionate with them as we are with our friends. And then from the perspective of those people who are on the hero's journey and who are in the public eye, you know, recognized as great for something, whether it's athletics or salesmanship, business, politics, music, art, whatever, you have an obligation. If you're going to represent yourself as someone who should be watched and listened to and admired, then you need to understand what is required of you if you want to be a hero. And it isn't just winning games. It's having courage, compassion, and wisdom.
Well, backing up a little bit, it seems to be such a common human characteristic to judge other people and find fault. And I was just thinking of a few things from the Bible when you were talking about Jesus, about how you shouldn't judge another man until you've walked a mile in his shoes, or you know, focus on the speck in his eye unless you remove the log in your own, or let he who's without sin cast the first stone. I mean, there are a lot of pieces of wisdom that come from the Bible that speak to some of the things you were just talking about. And I wonder, what do you think it is that makes humans so judgmental, and what are some of the ways that we can avoid falling into that trap so that we can try to find common ground with people and build each other up instead of tear each other down?
Yeah, it is a great temptation. I mean, it's certainly one that I give into routinely. I mean, I think there's, you know, part of it is our own insecurity. If we can judge somebody else, you know, it makes us feel superior. It's sort of similar to racism in the sense of, these people are inferior to me, that makes me feel better about myself. You know, it's always, you know, you feel better if you're standing on top of somebody, and sometimes to do that you have to push them down. And so I think there's an element of that in it. On the other hand, I think judging in the sense of being analytical and recognizing the errors of other people can be useful.
Yes.
You know, I mean, we learn not only by making errors ourselves, but we learn by observing other people making errors and thinking, well, I don't want to do that, or I don't want to be like that. So, like so many things, there's two edges to that sword.
I agree. Well, I'm interested in the fact that you have a master's in divinity, and of course you've practiced law for many decades. Did you ever practice ministry?
No, I actually had planned to, as I was easing my way out of law. I thought that I would go into ministry, and I was a lifelong Presbyterian. So I began this process of becoming a ministerial candidate, and I discovered that my own theological understandings were not acceptable to the Presbyterian establishment as represented by the Presbytery Committee that was to judge me as a ministerial candidate. At one meeting with the committee, this one elderly lady looks at me and she says, "What? I think you're a Buddhist." And that remark sort of made it clear that we were not on the same wavelength. And in fact, they offered to send me to Calvinist Reform School.
Oh my!
Even though I had graduated as valedictorian of my seminary class, which I went to while practicing law, and I really didn't think I needed to learn more about Calvinism. It wasn't a lack of understanding; it was a matter of disagreement. But they thought that a good Presbyterian minister had to be a strict Calvinist. Which Calvin had a lot of interesting things to say, but ultimately his fundamental theology was fairly ridiculous. What he's most known for, predestination, that everything that happens in our universe was predestined by the Creator God before the beginning of the universe. And so we're all just living out this sort of dream that occurred before the beginning of time. And in a way, I mean, there's a poetic aspect to that, but in terms of thinking about, okay, so here I am talking with David on the phone, this was planned by God before the beginning of time. I mean, what's the point of even believing such a thing? I mean, to me, it makes life seem utterly ridiculous and meaningless. So, anyway, it didn't go well, and I was sort of drummed out of the Presbyterian Church, which was probably a good thing, because for years I had to stand up in church and recite the Apostles' Creed, which is this litany of belief statements, many of which I didn't believe, but I either said it out of peer pressure or said it when I was younger because I thought I was, you know, supposed to and was trying to believe those things, but was eventually liberated from it. And so I left the Presbyterian Church and eventually landed in a Quaker meeting, which is what I've been attending for the last few years.
Well, that's a very interesting transition. What were your feelings about that? I mean, you speak about being liberated, but there must have been some other feelings that went along with that as well.
Well, it was painful in several ways. I mean, first of all, it was painful because I thought as a minister that would be a useful platform to do some good work. At that point in my life, I was financially independent. I didn't really need a job. But I thought, you know, being a pastor or minister in the sense of ministering to people would be a good way to spend the next stage of my life. So having that denied was kind of painful. Also, my family has been Presbyterians for generations. When I was a little boy, we'd sit in our family pew in our church in Goshen, Indiana, with four generations. My great-grandmother, who lived to be 98, through, you know, grandparents, parents, and my brother and me. And so to break with that tradition, there was some amount of pain associated with that as well. But as it is, the sense of liberation outweighed that. And I'm glad to have gone through that and left the Presbyterian Church behind.
Well, let's talk about some of your life adventures. I'm especially interested in hearing about the adventures that you've had in the Himalayan mountains and the work that's come out of that for you in your writing.
Well, I had turned 40 and was having what appeared to be a kind of classic midlife crisis. I was working hard, had two kids, was the senior partner in a small law firm, and came home from the office, appearing stressed too many times, I think, and my wife slapped down a brochure in front of me about trekking in the Himalayas and said, "Why don't you go do this?" So she was basically saying, "Hey, buddy, go take a hike and do it on the other side of the world," which was terrific advice, because traveling had always been a part of my life that was important to me and I enjoyed, and I wasn't feeding that need in that period of my life. So a friend and I went over to Nepal, and we trekked up the Mount Everest Base Camp Trail, and it was just a wonderful experience on various levels. The majesty of the mountains was awe-inspiring, and I really enjoyed the Sherpa people, the high mountain people. They combined this wonderful kindness, the kind of what we think of as that Buddhist gentleness, and at the same time were the strongest people I'd ever encountered. I've been an athlete all my life, but my God, these guys who were like 5'4" and weighed 120 pounds would carry 70 to 90 pounds in a basket roped around their foreheads, miles and miles, hours and hours up the highest mountains in the world. And and at the same time, didn't have the kind of aggressive, ambitious personalities that we associate with great athletes. They're very gentle. And it was just intriguing to me. So I wanted to learn more about the culture, and I decided I wanted to be able to actually get up in the mountains rather than just hike the trails. And so I went to a couple climbing schools and started going back on mountaineering expeditions. And after several mountaineering expeditions, had an experience which once again really reoriented me, because three local Nepali porters were killed in an avalanche right above my climbing team and me, and we weren't hurt. We just sort of caught the tail end of the avalanche, but these three guys were killed. And they were killed because they were on a higher, treacherous trail, taking a shortcut to get their clients' gear back to the airstrip to fly out of the mountains. And it stunned me to think that these lives were lost just so that we well-off Westerners could have a great adventure. Mm. And that was in 1999. And so I thought, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. And decided I wouldn't go back to Nepal and wouldn't do any more mountaineering, and did a few years of solo sea kayaking expeditions. But then in 2003, Sir Edmund Hillary, who was an old man and the king of Nepal, sent out messages and invitations to trekkers and climbers all over the world, asking them to come to Nepal to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the first summit of Mount Everest, which had been in 1953. So I decided what I wanted to do is to go back and try to look at this from a different perspective, and I wanted to write about it. So I hiked all through the Khumbu region, which is the where the Sherpas live, just below Mount Everest, and interviewed Sherpas from lowly porters to Lama Tenzing, who's the high Lama of the Sherpa people, as well as mountaineers from all over the world. And I didn't get to interview Hillary because he stayed in Kathmandu, but I interviewed his son, Peter, and his older sister, June, and a bunch of members of their family, and came to the conclusion that just to abandon this country and culture that I had come to love was really wrong-headed, and that Hillary had set a wonderful example, because what he did after he became rich and famous was to de-emphasize his life as a mountaineer and to emphasize his life as a philanthropist. And because of him and the money he raised through a foundation he started, there are water projects and hydroelectric projects and schools and hospitals and medical clinics all through the Khumbu region. So I decided I would try to do that same, follow his lead, see him as a guide, a life guide, and on a much smaller scale, replicate what he did. And so I had hooked up with a mountaineering company, a trekking company called Adventure Geotreks, I had become friends with the owner of that company, a guy named Nehru Rai, and his people, the Rai people, live just below the Sherpa people. So the Sherpas tend to live from about 8,000 feet up to 16,000 feet. The Rai people tend to live a little bit lower than that, but up to about 12,000 feet. So they intermingle. And Nehru, his home village was the home village of many guys that had worked for me as porters and cooks and guides on expeditions that I had been on through Adventure Geotreks. And they had a little village school that had three grades, and they wanted to add a fourth and a fifth grade. So they asked me if I could raise $5,000, which would pay for the addition of the two classrooms to the school and pay the salaries of two teachers. And teachers are paid $40 a month, and materials aren't very expensive, and the villagers would do all the work, so there was no labor costs involved. And it was kind of amazing. $5,000 could pay to add on two classrooms and hire two teachers. And anyway, so I agreed to do that, and that was in 2007, and that was the beginning of the Bassa Village Foundation. And since then, with the help of friends who've become members of the foundation, we've funded with the villagers' building hydroelectric system, so their village has electricity, which it didn't have before, a water system, so they don't have to walk for half an hour down a steep mountainside to their stream with buckets to get all their water. It now comes to spigots outside of their houses. Computers for their school, smokeless stoves for their homes, so they aren't breathing in smoke every time they cook or heat their houses, and various other smaller developments, and so we're trying to use BASA as a model for what we call culturally sensitive development in that part of the world, or at least that area of Nepal. And we had just gotten to the point where we were almost finished. We had one more project we were going to do, which was toilets, because the village doesn't actually have toilets. And then in 2015, the earthquakes of April and May struck and knocked down many of the homes in the village, damaged the school. And so for the last year, we raised money to rebuild the village, and the villagers have been rebuilding their village. And we're hoping by next year that will all be completed, and we're going to have the latrine project finished, and a bunch of us are going to go to BASA to celebrate, and then we'll move on to another village.
That's amazing. What are some of the lessons that you learned from the way the villagers lived?
Well, they live very communally. You know, they now actually have cell phone service. It just reached them a year ago, but they don't have TVs, they don't have radios. Their lives are very much involved with each other. So the sense of community is just amazing compared to what we're used to. I mean, I grew up in a small town in Indiana where we had a very deep sense of community, but it's nothing compared to theirs. You walk up to somebody in BASA and point to somebody else, and they can relate five generations back of everybody in the family of that other person, not just their own. And they're just so, you know, their lives are so intertwined with each other. They each have their own farming plots on the terraced mountainside. But if a villager is hurt or sick, others just do the work for him, which I've seen several times, because I've been there five times now myself and spent time in the village. And they also, they know how to have fun, you know, without television, movies, all our modern forms of entertainment and stimulation. What they do, they get together, they sing, they dance, they drink, they eat. They have lots of festivals, and they like to party. and so it's fun to hang out with them. But the main lesson I've learned is to just value human relationships.
Mm. Well, I'm wondering what, if any, heroes you met while you were there. It sounds like there were the makings for several heroes amongst the Sherpa people and in the BASA villages.
Yeah, I think of almost every guide that I've had over there in at least quasi-heroic terms. These guys are really amazing. I mean, like their strength and their kindness, which I've already mentioned. But the ones who get to be guides also are very well educated. They speak multiple languages because they need to communicate not just with English speakers, but French, Italian, Russian, all over Europe. They deal with all the European languages, Japanese, Chinese. I mean, the typical, what we call Sirdar, which is head guide, will probably know about seven foreign languages and many, many local dialects, because there are actually 50 different major ethnic groups in Nepal, and each one has its own local language. And so as you're traveling through the different areas, you need to know each local language. So they're amazing human beings. Just one little example, when that avalanche hit, our guide, whose name was Seth, our porters were trapped on the other side of the avalanche. Well, he told us, meaning his climbing clients, so, you know, you guys go on, just follow the path, you'll get to Lukla, the village where the airstrip is. And because he had to go back to help our porters. So he had to climb back up this sheer mountain face where the avalanche had occurred, found our porters, found one of them was not in good shape, couldn't walk, carried him down the mountainside, climbed back up, picked up his doko, which is the basket with the gear he was carrying, carried it down, and then to get to Lukla, helping one of the porters and carrying the porter's load as well as his own backpack, they had to cross three streams, and each stream was getting higher. And they got to the third stream, and it was neck high. And
wow.
Seth crossed it himself, tied a rope, but the injured porter could not make it across. So they had to sleep on the bank of that river, soaking wet, cold Himalayan night. And the next morning, when they finally came walking into Lukla, Seth was whistling. You know, to him, it was just, that's all in a day's work. So, you know, that demonstration of courage, compassion for, you know, a fellow coworker, is pretty amazing to me. Now, the wisdom, I can't say that I have necessarily found all of the Sirdars as great fonts of wisdom. But whose name is Ganesh, which we would pronounce Ganesh, once remarked to me, when I go into a Buddhist temple, I'm a Buddhist. When I go into a Hindu temple, I'm a Hindu. When I go to a Christian church, I'm a Christian. And when I come home to Basa village, I am a Rai, which is their own tribal ethnic group. And what he was saying is all of these different, you know, religions and cultures he could adapt to and feel comfortable in and feel part of in the moment and still come home and be what he had been as that he had grown up with his people. And which I just found that delightful. And I've seen him in each of those different settings.
I love it. Well, this might be a good opportunity to segue into your last book before Hero's Journey, which was called Godless, Living a Valuable Life Beyond Beliefs. I'm interested in what you just said and how your book advocates for placing intolerant religious doctrines and extremist political ideologies with positive values and pragmatic decision-making. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, the book really has three parts to it, and the first part is a critique in what I think is a sort of laying out a case like a lawyer does, a demonstration that ideologies, whether they're religious or whether they're political, always fall short of grasping reality, and people try to guide their lives by living up to those ideologies, do not see reality in its full and vivid self, as they are looking at reality through the prisms that these ideologies have imposed on them. And by that, I mean, whether it's Marxism, Christianity, liberal Democrat, conservative Republican, all the labels that we can come up with to apply and that people apply to themselves what the person who does that to himself or herself is limiting. Limiting the self, limiting the ability to relate to other people, to understand reality. Because as soon as you have adopted that ideology, applied that label to yourself, you have now created a wall between you and somebody who doesn't agree with that. Mm. And that leads to violence and wars and just about every bad thing that happens in human relations. And so what I suggest we should do to replace that is, you know, just stop believing in these ideologies and doctrines. Forget them. They're not helpful. They're harmful. And that instead, we should guide our lives by fundamental values, which most everybody agrees with. I mean, things like, well, like what we've talked about, courage, compassion, wisdom, but there's many others, kindness, decency, being healthy, eating a proper diet, exercising, being a good neighbor. I mean, these are just the sort of the ordinary values that most of us try to live by. Just stop, focus, understand. That's where you can find your best self, as opposed to trying to fit yourself into, you know, being a Calvinist or being a communist or being a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican. Because, you know, that just divides the world into us and them.
What is it about human nature that you think makes us attach ourselves to labels therefore become divisive instead of becoming more cohesive and trying to find that common ground with our fellow quote-unquote man?
Yeah, I think it's fear and weakness, insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's have these labels and these ideologies give you a firm foundation to stand on. So they provide you with answers. So you don't have to think for yourself anymore. Once you figure out, oh, you know, I'm a conservative Republican. Okay, well, now I can stop thinking for myself because that gives me all of the answers. And it's the same for being a Presbyterian or being a Quaker or, you know, all of the organizations that say, here's the ideology to follow, and you've got all the answers you need, that gives you security. Yeah, but it's a false sense of security. If you live a full life and you encounter other people and you're open to other people, you know, you'll realize, oh my gosh, you know, that woman or that guy, they seem to really have it together, and they're not a conservative Republican or they're not a Methodist. Now, how does that work? How can it be that? And so you can respond to that by, well, I'm just not going to think about it. I'm just going to stick with that label, that's who I am. Or you can continue to participate in that community, that Methodist church, if you will, but recognize I'm here because I want to be part of this community, but it doesn't give me all the answers through its theology, its doctrines, dogmas, creeds, and so forth.
Well, it sounds like the willingness to stay open-minded is important in terms of not falling into that trap.
Exactly. And the third part of the book is kind of an encomium to the Quakers and to the Rye people and to the one and only philosophy that America has produced, which is pragmatism. Because the Rye people and the Quakers, they don't have any set doctrines. which is what I came to admire about the Quakers. What they have are questions, but they don't provide specific answers. And the Rye people, they just have stories. They don't have a particular theology. They don't have a written language, but they tell stories, which I find quite wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And then American pragmatism, the essence of that philosophy is just figure out what works. You know, approach problems like you're a physician or a scientist. You're just trying to figure out what works. You know, you don't approach it with, well, I'm a liberal Democrat, so I know the answer. Or I'm a Roman Catholic, I know the answer. No, you just approach, okay, let's look at the facts, what's going on here. Okay, now I understand what the problem is. What's the best solution as human beings in community we can come up with? And that philosophy was developed by some of the most brilliant minds of our country back in the early 19th century, William James being probably the most famous. And it's a great approach, particularly in politics. But mm-hmm. it seems to be one we Americans have forgotten.
It seems that we could benefit from going back to a lot of the philosophies that we've forgotten about the foundation of this country and what it was all about.
Yeah. I mean, the founding fathers didn't come up with a perfect solution to everything, slavery, of course, being the most obvious one. But there was great wisdom back then, and I think it was improved upon by philosophers like James. I mean, real, you know, social thinkers who he thought deeply about human psychology and social reality. And ultimately, what he came up with was just take a pragmatic approach. Don't start with an ideology. Don't start with preconceived notions. Just understand the problem, and then let's work together to figure out a solution.
That, to me, is what wisdom is all about, keeping it simple.
Yeah, I mean, just think how much better our Congress would work if that's the approach they took.
How true. Well, the hour has passed quickly, and what is the best way for people to get in touch with you? Through your website?
Yeah, my email is on the website, and so they can contact me through that. I also have an author page in Amazon, which, of course, lists all my books, but they can also contact me through there. So I'm always delighted to hear from readers or people interested in experiencing the Himalayas or people interested in getting involved with the Bhatta Foundation.
Beautiful. And where are the best places for people to find your books?
Well, the easiest place is probably on Amazon. I mean, any bookstore can order them, as well as any, you know, retailer. But, yeah, so wherever you find your books, if they don't have it, they can order it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining me tonight. I really have enjoyed the hour.
No, thank you, David. It has gone quickly. I've definitely enjoyed talking to you and hope we get to do it again.
That sounds good. Well, I wish you well. And so once again, we'll come to a close. Now let's pause and reflect upon the idea that we're all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night, Jeff.
Good night, David.